Let's look now at yogic practices for reducing both rajas and tamas, and in doing so, cultivate sattva. You ready? Now, some of these practices I'm sharing in these lectures, I'm going to presume you already know from your yoga teacher training, and others you'll find in the practice library. So in order to cultivate sattva, we need to reduce the dominance of tamas and rajas. As one of my teachers, Saraswati Vasudevan, says, you can't cultivate sattva by having a cup of sattvic tea. You cultivate sattva by reducing tamas and rajas. As you know, as yoga teachers, we can support our students to cultivate sattva by sharing specific practices, including asana, pranayama, and meditation in class that reduce rajas and tamas, by offering different variations of practices that have an emphasis more on reducing rajas or tamas, depending on the way we practice them, letting students know the potential benefits of practices we teach and encouraging them to use the practices outside yoga class to self-regulate and bring themselves to a more sattvic state. Avoid or provide psychoeducation about practices that have the potential to be triggering or imbalancing for students experiencing depression, anxiety, stress, and trauma. So in subsequent lectures, we're going to look at practices for reducing tamas and rajas, but there are some practices that are helpful in cultivating sattva for those experiencing depression, anxiety, trauma and stress, regardless of which guna is predominant. This is what we're going to look at now. So let's start with asana. So the first thing, coordinating movement to the breath, not the other way around. So these photographs here are from a simple sequence that I love to share with my students at the beginning of class. And you'll see that everyone is doing something slightly different in the photo, which I think means that I'm teaching it well. So it's a simple, accessible, and embodied way to introduce this concept of coordinating movement to the breath. So with a student sitting on the floor, either in a cross-legged position or straddling a bolster or whatever's comfortable, I invite my students to inhale and reach their arms up overhead, and then exhale and lower their arms back to their knees or to the floor. So we've practiced this a few times together to get the hang of it and to create an interpersonal rhythm with the whole class, so we're all moving together. I then invite the students to link the movement with their own natural breathing rhythm. So I'll say something like this, and perhaps you'd like to try it with me as you're watching this lecture. Wait for your inhalation, and when it comes, bringing the arms up overhead, feeling the full length of the breath with the movement. And then waiting for your next exhalation. And when it comes, lowering the arms down again, feeling the full length of the breath with the movement, continuing to breathe and move like this in your body's own natural rhythm, perhaps three times more. Your rhythm is likely to be a different pace than mine and different to others in the class. And so the invitation is to tune into your own breath and to move in accordance with it. Okay, so this creates an interpersonal rhythm, like we talked about in an earlier lecture. And letting your students know how many times to repeat the practice helps the sequence to be predictable. It lets the students know when it will end, and it gives your students autonomy over their own practice. You can see how it's all fitting together now, right? Watch how I do this in the yoga classes as well. So when you're teaching, use language that emphasizes inhabiting the body and sensing what's unfolding in the body during movement and while holding asanas. This encourages interception and embodiment. So instead of telling people what to feel, invite them to sense or notice what is unfolding as sensation in the body. So noticing has more of a quality of engaging the mind, and sensing has more of a quality of engaging the intelligence of the body. So you can do this in any asana you like. I like to introduce this concept in my classes by inviting students to come on all fours in tabletop position with their hands and knees on the mat, like you can see in the photo, and then inviting them to lift their left hand off the floor 1 centimeter. And to notice and sense all the micro movements that happen in the body to support them to do this. Noticing how our body supports them to move in this way. It's a very small movement. It triggers a cascade of movements and sensation in the body. It's so, so interesting. And then we experiment with the right hand and then the right knee and then the left knee, one at a time, noticing, sensing, and being curious about what is unfolding in the body as we lift each limb just a centimeter from the floor. And then it can also lead into lifting the left arm parallel with the floor and doing the same with the other limb. So perhaps even playing with lifting the left arm and the right leg and then the right arm and the left leg and so on. So it really sets the scene for being present with inhabiting the body and being present to the unfolding sensation and the small movements, which hopefully translates over to the large movements later on. Watch out for how I teach this in the yoga class. Virabhadrasana, warrior poses, to embody strength and grounding. So as long as we have the capability, these postures can be helpful for us all, no matter which guna is dominant. So I found in my own personal yoga practice that I naturally feel strong and grounded when I do warrior poses, even if I'm not consciously thinking about the rationale behind them or trying to embody these qualities as I practice. Just offering these postures can support students to feel strong and grounded, and there might not be any actual need to name their potential benefits. And actually, by not naming them, you won't ostracize anyone who might not be feeling these qualities when they practice. Now, I'm not saying that you should never name the potential qualities or benefits of the practices. Sometimes it can be really helpful to invite students to feel strong and grounded while they're practicing one of the Virabhadrasana postures. But always be mindful that while it might be helpful for some students, others won't be feeling the qualities that you mentioned. They might be feeling shaky or dissociated, and they could end up feeling confused or stupid or triggered if they think that they're feeling the wrong effect in the practice. In a similar way, balancing postures like Vrikasana or tree pose can be taught to feel strong and to stabilize the mind. So it's pretty hard to think and balance at the same time. So balancing postures can be a great thing to do when you have a busy mind. And when you're attending to proprioception, which you might remember is the awareness of the position of the body in space, and interoception, which is the unfolding awareness of the unfolding sensations within the body, it requires even more focus and is therefore even more difficult to think about other things or to ruminate while you're practicing. I reckon that Vrikasana is a great posture to share a little bit of information about balancing in the mind. And you can see how I do this in one of the yoga classes. So as students have finished the posture on one leg, you could give them this information during the transition to the other leg, and then they can try it out for themselves, for example. Now, we always need to be aware that everyone will have a different experience of this, and some people will be able to balance and ruminate at the same time. So always share this information and any other information like this in a way that invites people to try it out for themselves and to gather evidence for themselves as to what's helpful or unhelpful for them. So let's take a look now at general contraindications and precautions for students experiencing depression, anxiety, trauma, and stress. So these are asanas to avoid or to be mindful of. So students with a history of trauma may be triggered by intense physical asanas. So if you're working with a population of trauma survivors, I suggest offering less strong postures. If you're working with a general population and decide to offer strong postures, always make sure that this is clear in the class description, that this is what you're going to be offering, like on your website or on your flyers. And always offer alternatives and be aware of the potential for these postures to be triggering for some students. If we're not careful, asana classes can sound really regimented and controlling. If we tell students precisely when and how to move and breathe, this can be triggering for some people who have had an experience of trauma that involved being controlled. It can also encourage students to override their own instincts about their body, which really is the opposite of what we're trying to do in yoga. Instead, teach in a way that's invitational, inclusive, non-judgmental, accurate, fosters connection, and encourages curiosity. So be mindful of everything in the sections on creating a safe container, ethics, and therapeutic skills. Okay, so avoid using straps in your classes and avoid teaching in a studio that has ropes or yoga straps hanging from the wall, like you see in some Iyengar yoga studios. For someone who's experienced trauma that involved being tied up or restrained, this can be really triggering. But if for some reason you do choose to use yoga straps in your classes, make sure that you always offer a variation that doesn't include the strap and always allow the student to use the strap themselves rather than you tying or wrapping them up in it. So demonstrate on yourself first so the student knows what to expect, and then let them know how long the practice will last so they know when it will come to an end. Students who are triggered by using straps or by seeing other students in the class using the straps may be able to tolerate it if they know exactly what's going to happen and when it will end. It comes back to being predictable, like we talked about earlier. Be aware that Ananda Balasana, happy baby pose, can be triggering for some people, especially if they have an experience of sexual abuse. So in their research on yoga for individuals with trauma, Bessel van der Kolk and Emerson found that while happy baby pose was triggering for some students, it was actually helpful for others when they could overcome their fear and do the pose calmly. And after much discussion, they decided that happy baby pose was actually appropriate to teach, but only when taught very gently and while encouraging students not to try it if it made them feel uncomfortable. Now, personally, I don't teach this pose, but I'm surprised at the number of times students choose this pose for themselves when I invite them to choose their own practice towards the end of class. And Shavasana. Now, Shavasana can be a real time for rumination for students experiencing depression, anxiety, trauma, and stress. So I suggest keeping Shavasana short to around 5 minutes max, or including instead a guided meditation practice rather than lying in silence. The silence can actually be really triggering for some students. Now for me, silence is bliss. I love it. But this is not true for everybody. It's important not to tell people to close their eyes or to use an eye pillow in Shavasana or in any other position for that matter. It's important that students feel free to choose whether they have their eyes open or closed. I'm going to talk about this more in the meditation section, but I just wanted to flag it here now. Let's move to pranayama now. Pranayama can be incredibly helpful for students experiencing mental health challenges, but it can also be incredibly challenging and triggering. The key, I think, is to keep it simple. As Bessel van der Kolk says in his book on trauma, The Body Keeps Score, many of our patients are barely aware of their breath. So learning to focus on the in and the out breath, to notice whether the breath was fast or slow, and to count the breaths in some poses can be a significant accomplishment. I believe that the most important part of any pranayama practice is sensing the breath just as it is, without trying to fix or change anything. We're also used to trying to change our internal experience through food, drugs, alcohol, sex, or social media, or even through yoga, that we've forgotten how to be present with ourselves. Sensing the breath and therefore being present with ourselves can be a really new and profound experience for our students. Being present with ourselves, just as we are, is a truly radical act of presence and self-acceptance. How often do we allow ourselves to be and accept ourselves just as we are without trying to fix, improve, or change anything? It can feel like sometimes we're a constant self-improvement project with no end in sight. Often just sensing the breath just as it is all the pranayama practice that we need. And it really acknowledges a willingness to be with ourselves just as we are. So here are two different ways to notice and sense the breath. Firstly, listening to the breath is a really accessible way for many students to begin practicing pranayama. Students who feel disconnected from their bodies through trauma or through an overly intellectual existence often find it really difficult or intolerable to feel the movement of the breath in the body. So inviting them to listen to the breath can be a safer and more accessible way for them to experience it. You might suggest that they listen for the sound of the breath in the nostrils or perhaps at the back of the throat, and this might actually naturally create a gentle Ujjayi pranayama type sound. Make sure that you always let your students know that it's okay if they can't hear anything at all. Remember, not all practices are for everyone, and we don't want our students to think they can't do yoga if they can't hear their breath. And secondly, my favorite way to work with the breath is to notice and sense the breath in the body. To be honest, this is what makes up the majority of my personal pranayama practice, and this is my go-to when I'm feeling stressed or overwhelmed. I'm a huge fan of simple. So try inviting your students to notice or sense the movement of the air in the nostrils as they breathe in and out. And then perhaps after they've been doing that for a while, and only if it feels okay, invite them to notice or sense the movement of the breath in the chest. And after they've been practicing this for a while, invite them to feel the movement in their belly, known as abdominal or diaphragmatic breathing, with the belly rising or gently expanding with the inhalation and releasing or gently contracting with the exhalation. It can be really helpful to invite students to place their hands on their chest or their belly to get that extra sensory feedback when they do this practice. Now, for some students, it's going to be easier for the belly to move freely when they're lying down. So you might like to offer this pranayama practice when they're lying down or in shavasana. And even though the research tells us that diaphragmatic breathing is helpful in reducing stress and anxiety, it's important to know that some students find abdominal breathing difficult or even impossible. So make sure that you only offer this practice as a suggestion and invite students to let it go if they feel uncomfortable or confused. I want to show you here a video of Macy. I was so blessed to be a doula at Macy's birth, and this is Macy at 4 weeks old with a tummy full of breast milk asleep on her mum's belly. Take a look at her belly. She's naturally doing abdominal breathing. This is our natural state when we're calm and happy. And if you listen, it almost sounds like she's doing Ujjayi breath. Now you see that babies breathe much faster than adults. You can see the pace of her mum breathing in comparison. Okay, that's enough baby spam. I could watch this baby for hours. She's so gorgeous. On to the next pranayama practice. Okay, so after we've given our students the opportunity to sense the breath just as it is, we might offer pranayama practices to regulate the breath. However, for many students, and especially those with significant mental health challenges, being aware of and getting acquainted with the rhythm of the breath may be all that they can tolerate, and in fact, all that's needed. If you choose to teach pranayama practices to regulate the breath, it can be as simple as an instructions for students to regulate the breath to be calm and steady. Try this out for yourself. It's actually really surprising how effective this simple cue is. As it's a fairly open instruction and there are no confusing breathing patterns or mudras to use, it can be really effective for students who are new to yoga, for those who find yoga a little bit strange, for students who tend to get confused or flustered easily, or for those who have had their breath controlled during a traumatic experience, like during strangulation. In this pranayama practice, students are in full control of the timing and the experience of regulating the breath, so it can be more accessible and doable and indeed just as effective. Samavritti pranayama, or equal breathing, is a gentle pranayama practice to support students to equalize the length of the inhalation and the exhalation. So a longer inhalation activates the sympathetic or the fight or flight branch of the autonomic nervous system, and an extended exhalation activates the parasympathetic or the rest and digest branch. And so coming back to this slide now, Samavritti pranayama provides a balance between sympathetic and parasympathetic effects. It's often calming and can be a great starting point for lengthening either the inhalation or the exhalation, depending on the needs of the student. We'll look at this more in the Rajas and Tamas sections. So I've noticed that in many students who are experiencing anxiety, that their exhalation is shorter than their inhalation. And so by equalizing the breath, they're actually lengthening the exhalation in comparison to what it was previously. And so some of Vritti Pranayama can actually have a relatively relaxing effect for these students. These students often find it difficult to extend the exhalation longer than the inhalation. And so supporting them to make the exhalation the same length as the inhalation is often enough and can be really helpful. So, you know, there are a number of ways you can support your students to equalize the breath. Simply inviting students to make their inhalations and their exhalations the same length is a simple and effective way to do this. Counting is another really common and effective way to equalize the breath, and it has the additional benefit of engaging the mind. Instead of counting your students through the entire practice in the rhythm of your breath, try inviting students to count four counts that match their natural inhalation, and then to match the rhythm of these same four counts on the exhalation. You can see how I do this in the practice library. Look up the Samavritti Pranayama practice. So teaching it in this way supports students to tune into their own natural rhythm and ensures that they won't extend the breath longer than is natural and comfortable for them. Other ways to equalize the breath are with a metronome, with the beat of the music, or while walking to the rhythm of their own steps. So coherent breathing is a practice developed by a guy called Stephen Elliott, and it involves gently breathing at 5 breaths per minute, which works out at about 6 seconds inhalation and 6 seconds exhalation. It's thought to be an effective way to enhance heart rate variability, which is important in the flexibility of the autonomic nervous system. It's often practiced using a sound, like a bell or a voice, to guide the timing. So it's important to note that coherent breathing at the prescribed rate of 5 breaths per minute is usually not appropriate for students new to pranayama due to the extended length of the breath. And it's best taught in a one-on-one situation so you can monitor your student individually and adapt the practice to their individual needs. So I would suggest starting with Samavritti Pranayama, just like we talked about, with the natural length of the inhalation and gently over a long period of time, lengthen the breath until the rate is 6 seconds for the inhalation and 6 seconds for the exhalation. So Nadi Shodhana Pranayama, or alternate nostril breathing, is another pranayama practice that's often balancing and calming. Now, from a yogic perspective, Nadi Shodhana Pranayama is designed to balance the Ida and Pingala nadis, which are the channels through the body in which prana can leave and enter. So the Ida Nadi passes through the left nostril and represents the cool energy of the moon, Chandra. And Pingala Nadi passes through the right nostril and represents the hot energy of the sun, Surya. So interestingly, this description lines up with contemporary autonomic nervous system research, which shows that left nostril breathing was associated with parasympathetic calming activity and right nostril breathing with sympathetic or activating activity. Overall, the research has found that alternate nostril breathing has a complex but balancing effect on these systems with a tilt towards parasympathetic dominance. It's important to only teach Nadi Shodhana Pranayama to students who have previous experience with breathing practices and are comfortable with sensing and regulating the breath. Start slowly, perhaps with 1 or 2 rounds, and build it up over time in accordance with the student's ability and preference. So for some guidance on how to teach Nadi Shodhana Pranayama, check out the practice library where you can see how I like to teach this practice. You can invite students to sit in a comfortable position and guide them gently through 1 round, inhaling left nostril, exhaling right, exhaling left. And then after this 1 round, invite students to sense the effects of the practice on their body, breath, and mind, and only encourage them to undertake further rounds if the practice felt easeful and if they didn't feel uncomfortable or dizzy. Now, when I practiced Nadi Shodhana Pranayama with Dr. Robert Svoboda, who is a renowned Ayurvedic practitioner and teacher, he insisted that we don't torture the nostrils. Now, this is not a particularly mental health aware statement, and I wouldn't suggest saying this to your students, but you get the picture, right? There's no need to press the nostrils with force. Encourage your students to press gently on the nostrils, which helps to bring a gentle and compassionate approach to the whole practice. And with students who are more experienced with Nadi Shodhana Pranayama, you can eventually practice without using the hands at all, visualizing the movement of prana through the nostrils with the hands resting on the knees or wherever's comfortable. The gross practice of using the hands is important as we become more familiar with the practice, and then transitioning to practicing without the hands makes it an even more subtle practice. You might like to try it out for yourself, even if you never share this subtle variation with your students. Brahmari Pranayama, or humming bee breath, is a calming and balancing practice. So the research has found that it promotes parasympathetic calming dominance, most likely as a result of the extended exhalation, which we looked at earlier, is related to parasympathetic dominance. The sound that we make during this practice, as well as having the arms raised, means that Brahmari Pranayama is also mildly activating. So it's a balancing practice, both calming, but also a little bit energizing. Also, the sound, especially when the fingers are gently pressed into the outer cartilage of the ear, creates a focus for the mind, potentially cutting through the ruminative thoughts, fostering interception, and supporting present moment awareness. Now, for some guidelines on how to teach Brahmari Pranayama, do check out the practice library. But basically, you invite your students to sit in a comfortable position, to inhale through the nose, and then exhale, keeping the mouth closed, making a kind of sound on the exhalation, like a humming bee. So you can invite them to try this for a few times and then sense the effects of the practice on the body, the breath, and the mind. And then if the students find the practice interesting or helpful and not at all uncomfortable, then you might invite them to gently press the cartilage between the cheek and the ear with the index fingers and repeat. So this creates a deeper sound and vibration, making it even more difficult to think ruminative thoughts while practicing it. So Brahmari Pranayama can also be practiced with the hands all over the face. And you might have learned this. You might have learned Brahmari Pranayama in this way, but I think it can be unnecessarily confusing for many students. And it could also be triggering for a student with an experience of trauma that involved having their eyes or their mouth closed forcibly. So I don't really see any reason to teach this more complicated version, unless you're particularly set on it for some reason. Now, chanting is not for all students at all, but in an appropriate setting and with interested students, it can be a wonderful tool for self-regulation and balance. As we saw in Gemma Perry's research, chanting Om had a positive effect on mood, especially when chanting out aloud. And other research has shown that chanting results in increased mental alertness and physiological relaxation. So I've included chanting in the pranayama section here, as chanting naturally extends the exhalation, which engages the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system, having a general calming effect. What I find really interesting is that when a teacher shares a chant with a student, either individually or as a group, and it's taught and practiced in a place where the student is feeling safe, connected, and included, the chant can become associated with this feeling of safety, connection, and inclusion. And by chanting it outside of the class when the student is feeling dysregulated, it can support them to connect back in with these feelings and self-regulate. It's fascinating, isn't it? Once I asked Ganesh Mohan about chanting. Now, Ganesh is a medical doctor, a yoga therapy teacher from Svastha Yoga, and the son of A.G. and Indra Mohan. And I asked him, which chant or mantra should we be giving to which student? He said it was less about the mantra itself and more about the environment and the transmission from the teacher. I thought that was really interesting. Let's take a look now at contraindications and precautions for pranayama. So sensing the breath and learning to breathe in a new way can be incredibly helpful for students experiencing depression, anxiety, stress, or trauma. But it can also be triggering and counterproductive if it's not taught sensitively and with authentic encouragement to adapt or cease the practice at any time. It's really not enough to give lip service to modifications. As teachers, we need to consistently remind our students to tune into their own needs and preferences and model this with our own behavior. When teaching pranayama, never insist on your students closing their eyes, as this can be triggering and feel unsafe for some students, particularly those experiencing anxiety or with a history of trauma. Either invite students to choose if they would prefer their eyes open or closed, or simply avoid giving any instructions about the eyes at all, and students will naturally gravitate towards one or the other, depending on what they prefer. You don't even need to mention it sometimes. With any pranayama practice, to reduce the likelihood of an ab reaction, start very gently and build up over a period of time. The focus needs to be on the breath being comfortable and easy without force. Now, in the wonderful book, The Heart of Yoga, T.K.V. Desikachar advises that students must only practice pranayama if they can breathe out slowly and gently, and only hold the breath if they can breathe in and out fully, and only if the breath retention does not disturb the breath. Always let your students know that if they begin to feel uncomfortable or dizzy, that they should cease the practice and breathe naturally. So in a group class, it's impossible to know what's really going on for all your students. In a private session, you probably have more of an idea, but even then you can't really know the full internal experience of your student. So it's important to preface any pranayama practice with instructions about what to do if they feel uncomfortable or dizzy in any way. Letting students know that pranayama is designed to be practiced in a way that's easeful and comfortable and not forceful or punishing in any way. Well, for most pranayama practices, we invite students to close their mouth and breathe through the nose, right? But it's important to know that this will not be comfortable or possible for all students. By all means, guide your students to breathe through the nose, but I suggest also offering the option to breathe through the mouth with the lips gently parted instead, or breathe in any way that feels natural and comfortable for the student. Natural and comfortable is much more important than getting the technique right. As we've looked at in the asana section, when you're teaching pranayama, try to avoid sounding controlling. If we're not careful, pranayama instructions can sound regimented and controlling, and this can be triggering for individuals who've had an experience of trauma that involved being controlled. It can also encourage students to override their own instincts about their breath, which is the opposite of what we want to do. So instead, use language that is invitational, inclusive, non-judgmental, accurate, fosters connection, and encourages curiosity. And finally, keep it simple. There's no need for fancy techniques. So let's take a look at meditation now. People experiencing depression, anxiety, stress, and trauma often have a very busy and ruminative mind. So engaging the mind with a guided mindfulness meditation practice can be really helpful. Many clients of mine over the years who experience mental health challenges have told me that they find unguided or self-directed meditation practices too hard or too triggering, and having someone to guide them through the practice is much more manageable and effective. So guided meditation practices might include eye rest meditation. So if you're training at eye rest, I highly recommend doing this. In a general or a drop-in class, make sure that you only focus on Anamaya and Pranamaya Kosha to keep it safe. Yoga Nidra, progressive muscle relaxation, body scan practices, visualizations, gratitude, self-compassion, counting the breath, or any other pranayama practices where you guide the students. Other ways to engage the mind during meditation include chanting Om, chanting another mantra or song, or listening to music. These are practices that students can do both in and out of class, and they have a meditative quality. Active meditations can also be helpful as they shift the focus away from the mind and the thoughts. So this might include sensing the body during asana. So asana becomes a meditation or a walking meditation practice. Indeed, anything can become a meditation practice: washing the dishes, walking the dog, having a shower, eating dinner, or even rolling up your yoga mat after class. Emptying the mind is a surprisingly helpful practice that my mentor Saraswati Vasudevan taught me. So Saraswati is a world-renowned yoga therapist and trainer, the founder of Yoga Vahini in India, and a consultant on the yoga psychology part of this training. So in this practice, rest in a comfortable position and then inhale and welcome the contents of the mind. And then exhale and empty the mind. Let it all go. And then in the pause after the exhalation, rest in the emptiness. If you go to the practice library, I'll guide you through the full practice there. Now, if you're teaching this to students, guide them through the practice several times, then invite them to continue in their own rhythm for as long as they like. But this practice isn't for everyone. Some students might feel frustrated that they're unable to empty their mind, and others might find resting in the emptiness really scary. However, I think it's surprising how emptying the mind is actually possible when we know we're going to pick it up again right away. And therefore, it can give students the felt experience of having some control over their mind, and they can have a bit of a break from their internal dialogue for a moment. I recommend keeping meditation practices short, even to just a couple of minutes, particularly for students new to meditation and those with moderate to severe symptoms. Also, it can be really quite helpful to let students know beforehand how long the practice will be, as it can be easier to tolerate something difficult if we know it isn't going to go on for very long and if we have a clear idea of when it's going to end. If students do find meditation difficult and they stick at it anyway, they may get the felt experience of doing something challenging and being okay, which can be so helpful in developing distress tolerance. But I must say, this is not something that we really want to particularly encourage our students to do, but rather could be an outcome that they experience for themselves in the safe container that we've created. Let's look now at contraindications and precautions for meditation. So individuals experiencing depression, anxiety, trauma, and stress often have a very active mind. If you don't give their mind something to focus on, they might ruminate, have anxious or depressive thoughts, feel triggered by their internal experience, or feel restless. So if you do offer meditation, keep the meditation short and give the mind something to focus on, especially at the beginning of class or at the beginning of the meditation practice. Always introduce meditation as optional, so students can choose to opt in or opt out of practicing meditation. And remember also that both asana and pranayama can be meditation when students are present with their body and their breath. So you might choose to not use the M word at all, as some students have had negative experience with meditation in the past and they feel adverse to it. So instead, you might weave an active or breath-focused practice into the class that has a meditative quality but isn't a formal meditation practice. Now, as I mentioned in the pranayama section, it's important not to insist on eyes being closed during meditation. This can be triggering or can feel unsafe for someone who's anxious or has a history of trauma. So consider either inviting students to choose if they would prefer their eyes open or closed, or simply avoid giving any guidelines about the eyes, and students will naturally gravitate towards one or the other depending upon their preference. And yes, you can practice meditation with the eyes open. There's been much criticism about the shadow side of meditation for individuals experiencing mental illness, and meditation can be harmful if it's not taught appropriately, sensitively, and to the needs of the individual student. Meditation has the potential to precipitate psychosis, exacerbate obsessive and schizoid traits, and release a debilitating flood of painful emotion in some seriously unwell individuals. In an article titled Meditation and Psychiatry, published in the peer-reviewed Psychiatry Journal, the author, McGee, advises considering to whom for what symptom, in what form, in what dose, and for how long, and provides the following information regarding the appropriateness of meditation as an adjunct to psychiatric care. The patient must not be psychotic or have too severe character disorder. This is otherwise known as a personality disorder, so as to avoid any psychiatric complications. Indications for meditation include the treatment of depression, anger, anxiety, stress, hypertension, addiction, insomnia, and chronic pain. Given its effects on awareness of self and others, ability and tolerance of affect, and ability to inhibit action, meditation is also a useful practice for patients with neurosis and mild to moderately severe character disorders who are plagued by defensiveness, lack of self-awareness, vulnerability to intense and painful affects, and self-destructive behaviors. If applied intelligently, meditation can help those who are sufficiently motivated to practice. That's interesting, that last bit, isn't it? That they're sufficiently motivated to practice. He also goes on to say, like a drug, meditation must be prescribed with careful attention to the psychological status of the patient. So in summary, if you're working with a population who has serious mental health issues, I suggest avoiding teaching meditation unless you have specialist skills in this area. If you have a student in a general yoga class whom you know has serious mental health issues, invite them to try other alternatives or ask them for permission if you can liaise with their mental health practitioner to assess the suitability of meditation for them. You need to get permission, of course, but you can absolutely call up or email your student psychologist or mental health professional and discuss the appropriateness of various practices that you're teaching. In a general yoga class, if meditation is taught within the guidelines I've suggested above in a thoughtful and sensitive way, is always presented as optional, and you hold a safe and compassionate container for your students, then the likelihood of harm is minimal and you've got nothing to worry about. Okay, I love supporting students to set intentions for themselves in class. Sankalpa translates to mean a resolution to make a difference, and bhavana to mean a heartfelt attitude that is held with the entire body and mind. And as such, sankalpa bhavana means a wholehearted intention. So try inviting your students to set a sankalpa bhavana or intention for themselves at the beginning of class and then asking them to check back in with it at the end of class. This is something that I do pretty much in all of my classes. This means that I'm being predictable, like we talked about earlier. The students really get used to it and it becomes second nature. Setting intentions can be a simple but powerful way to support your students to check in with their needs in that moment, to promote conscious action in alignment with those needs, to cultivate a sense of self-responsibility, so going within for the answers rather than seeking answers from professionals or from other people, and to cultivate a sense of agency, so a felt experience of taking effective action in the world. Individuals experiencing depression, anxiety, trauma, and stress may feel helpless and hopeless. They may feel disconnected from their needs at any given moment, like, I don't know what I need. And even if they know their needs, they may feel disempowered and unable to meet them, like, I just can't do it, or nothing I do ever works. Supporting your students to tune into their own needs, to set an intention based on those needs, and to make choices in alignment with the intention in the class can help them to have a very different experience and to overcome this. So, as a teacher, you might say, I invite you now to take a moment to set an intention for yourself for this class. Perhaps consider how you'd like to feel during and as a result of the class. Perhaps I practice in a way that is gentle and compassionate, or I'm strong and confident, or simply I am present. There's no right or wrong way of doing this. Simply stating your intention for your practice to yourself, feeling how it feels in the body, and then set it free. And then perhaps at the end of class, you might say, and as we're lying here in Shavasana, you might like to gently and compassionately state your intention again silently to yourself. And notice if another intention arises for the rest of your day. Now, according to one of my teachers, Dr. Richard Miller, the founder of iRest Yoga Nidra, there are three things to consider when we're languaging an intention. Firstly, using positive language. So try saying, I am present versus I'm not distracted. Secondly, using language in the present tense. So try saying, I am present versus may I be present, which holds the intention for some time in the future. And lastly, using concise and clear language. So try saying, I am present versus I would really like to be kind of focused in this very precise moment like I was at time last year, sometime when I studied with that teacher in New York. Feels different, right? When we state our intentions using these three guidelines, there's often a feeling of resonance in the body, as opposed to when we state the opposite of what we want or hold the intention for some time in the future or are imprecise and long-winded in our statements. Now, in a general yoga class, there may be no need to go into the details of the languaging of the intentions. This can become too intellectual and confusing sometimes. So instead, you could just adhere to these three points when you're providing examples. Some students will pick up on your languaging and use this style themselves. Others won't immediately, but likely will over time. And if you're offering a course or a more in-depth workshop where you have more time to speak more deeply and answer questions about intentions, it might be appropriate to spend more time considering the language of intentions, like in these three points above. When I teach a six-week iRest meditation course, we often sit in circle and I offer the students a short arriving meditation at the beginning of each class where I invite them to notice sensation and the breath to support them to arrive, and then invite them to ask themselves their intention for attending the course. I then give the students the opportunity to share their intention and, of course, making it very clear that there's no obligation to share at all. For some students with mental health challenges, setting an intention that feels overly positive can feel fake or depressingly impossible, so it's important to model intentions that are not just about positive mood states. While for some students, an intention about feeling love, happiness, or lightness might be appropriate and life-affirming, for others, an intention about being present, doing the best that I can, or being gentle with myself will be more affirming and helpful. Be really conscious of the language you use when communicating about intentions. Something you're probably doing in your classes anyway, but it's worth mentioning here, is weaving various themes into your classes. So some teaching themes that I like that are mental health aware and may be helpful for students, whether they're predominantly rajasic or tamasic, include self-compassion, gratitude, strong and gentle at the same time. This is one of my favorites. Like when your students are in Virabhadrasana saying something like strong in the legs, soft in the face, holding these opposites of strength and gentleness at the same time. Sthirasukha Asanam, that posture should be steady and comfortable. Meeting yourself where you are, like we've talked about previously. Finding a place of balance and stillness within that is always present, even in difficult asanas and in difficult times in life. If we've been doing moving postures and perhaps stretching to one side and then the other, or twisting to one side and then the other, I like to invite students to sit or stand in stillness. To find that natural place of balance and stillness within. There's nothing we need to do to find this place of equilibrium. We just need to come to stillness and allow our body to find its own natural equilibrium. Trusting the needs of your body, perhaps asking yourself, what do you need in this moment? Ahimsa, nonviolence. And the last last one I have here is noticing the state of the gunas and consciously cultivating sattva. Now, this list is not exhaustive. I'm sure you can get creative and come up with your own teaching themes that support your students' mental health in a subtle and gentle way. Poetry. Okay, this is definitely not for everyone, but I enjoy sharing poetry in my classes, especially when students are in Shavasana or a restorative pose. It can give students something to focus their minds on so they don't lapse into rumination and can communicate messages of acceptance, compassion, and hope in beautiful and subtle ways. As you're sharing poetry, you might invite your students to listen not just with their ears, but with their entire body. I'm going to give you a list now of some of my favorite poems in a minute, but I invite you now to have the experience of listening and absorbing one of my favorite poems. So you might like to close your eyes or leave them open if you prefer, and listen to the words, not just with your eyes, but with your entire body. Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about your despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Take a moment to let those words sink in. Perhaps even sensing the unfolding resonance or sensation in your body. Okay, so here's a list of some of my favorite poems that I feel fit beautifully with many of the messages from mental health or yoga. They're in alphabetical order. I couldn't even begin to put them in order of my favorites. Now, I'm not going to give you all the words of the poetry. I imagine that this would be breaking copyright and not in alignment with Asteya. But what I would like to give you are the titles and the authors so that you can seek these out yourself. So here we go. Always we hope someone else has the answer. Birthright, a blessing in the chaos. Chickpea to cook, everything is waiting for you. For longing, from out of the cave, the guest house, how to open your heart. If abandonment is the core wound, instructions. The Journey by David White. The Journey by Mary Oliver. Learning Life. Love After Love. The 1-inch Journey. The Patience of Ordinary Things. The Peace of Wild Things. The Question. Sometimes. Start Close In. The Summer Day. There Is a Brokenness. Trust. Wild Geese, The Word, The World Has Need of You, and Yes by Rudy Francisco. And to finish up this lecture on cultivating sattva, I thought I'd share with you another poem from this list called A Blessing by John Donohue. Here it is. May you awaken to the mystery of being here and enter the quiet immensity of your own presence. May you have joy and peace in the temple of your senses. May you receive encouragement when new frontiers beckon. May you respond to the call of your gift and find courage to follow its path. May the flame of anger free you from falsity. May the warmth of heart keep your presence aflame, and may anxiety never linger about you. May your outer dignity mirror an inner dignity of soul. May you take time to celebrate the quiet miracles that seek no attention. May you be consoled in the secret symmetry of your soul. May you experience each day as a sacred gift woven around the heart of wonder. Take a moment to let that settle in. Sensing what unfolds, the body, the breath, and the mind as a result of listening. Without judgment or expectation, simply a willingness to be present with whatever's here. Okay. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed this lecture on yoga practices for reducing both rajas and tamas. You can find many of these practices that I mentioned here in the practice library, and I look forward to seeing you over in the next lecture.